quality care. So I think something like that needs to be put in this 5A section to beyond what was mentioned in the next to the last bullet, stimulate innovation in providing culturally sensitive care. I think that a number of things we've been talking about here really speak to that.
Thank you. Yes.
The other thought I just had too that could lead to inequitable care is a diminished numbers or lack of minorities in clinical research, and that indirectly might lead to some just to the numbers being so low, just like it is in PDA.
Yeah. Any further comments? Yes, Colette.
I had a question about, do we want to also explicitly put something out there to the effect that if you want to call yourself a quality provider, you need to be looking for and addressing disparities? I mean, explicitly make that statement. Because otherwise...
That's a good suggestion. Yeah. People will pass. We'll take a pass. Yeah. Any other comments? Yes, Grace, I'm sorry, I missed it.
I should just put it up. So I'm actually not quite sure where this comment should go, but I would like to see as a goal or a stronger tie between the measurements that we find, or at least tie some of the measurements that we identify to the best practice recommendations that Angela had endorsed in the last couple of years. Internally, where I work, I've been struggling as to how to assign metrics to some of these best practices, and I think that without a stronger linkage there, we're not going to be able to really push those best practices for as quickly as, you know, I would like. And I know that we focus a lot on clinical quality measures and some of the other measurements. There are some best practices that could really be right for trying to explore some of the exploratory sentinel measures to see how we can measure those and put forth that linkage.
Thank you. Romana?
So I found this last 15 minutes a very interesting conversation, and in some ways, you know, we talked about under-resourced institutions really struggling to provide high quality of care. We spoke about cultural competence. There are a number of issues that we brought up. The thing that I think that really stands out for me is that when we use the language cultural competence, whether we put it in reports or we say that organizations need to focus on providing more culturally competent care, I think that what happens is that when we put that language out into the field without actually showing how to operationalize that, it becomes very, very confusing to the end users, whether they are the C-suite people, you know, the CEOs, the CMOs of hospitals or practices. So one of the things that I would really like to see in this section, when we speak about cultural competence, maybe we should provide some key examples of what that means in practice. So one thing in particular, and we've heard the language of navigators and community health workers, is really using a team-based approach. Because I think given that there is language in the ACA for reimbursing on team-based approach and really focusing on primary care, and it ties directly to kind of overstretched institutions and overstretched providers, especially those who are caring for vulnerable populations, I really feel that it's important for that language to be there under the umbrella of cultural competence, because you can really work with community health workers to provide care that is culturally competent. I just have an issue with that language because I do think that it resonates for all of us here and for many of the people that we speak to, but not necessarily out in the field. I still think, you know, you kind of get this, oh, that's kind of nice. Well, yeah, of course we'll do that.
Agreed. So Grace or Dennis?
I just want to respond.
Okay, go ahead.
I very much agree, but if you're going to go down that path, then it's more than that. You know, it's not just teams, or you can be a bit prescriptive or, you know, suggestive, but there's kind of an extensive group of recommendations you might make. That's a solid one, but that is one of many.
No, and I completely agree with you. So I guess I support what you say, Dennis, but I also would like to see explicit language about team-based care and using for examples of community health workers and patient navigators and such.
Okay, Grace, and then Marshall.
Right, and to Lamont's point, maybe specifically adding language that says, you know, a part of the team should draw from the community that it serves. Mm-hmm. I think that's very critical. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, to your point, that's exactly the way that NGA has offered it in putting forth some of those best practice, preferred practice standards, and that they actually did cite some examples of, you know, here's what we mean by, you know, this particular standard. So maybe the team-based approach is only one, and then I'm sure that we can brainstorm and generate some others as examples.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to, again, another key example is in use of electronic health records. You know, what kind of information can be loaded in with regard to tracking, monitoring disparities, and cultural competence-related language-related priorities.
Okay, so.
And Joe Bettencourt and his team have all sorts of really good languages on cultural competency that they can pull from. So
we're going to start back over here. We're going to go Marshall, Francis, and then we'll go down the other side.
So, and, you know, I think Ramona's suggestion to be more specific about cultural competency makes a lot of sense. I think there's a sort of a general caution that we need to keep in mind also. It's also reflected in the title of this committee, Health Disparities and Cultural Competency Consensus Standards. I think like when we all started years ago in this area, you know, it was really sort of cultural competency, language services. I mean, it was really sort of a limited number of things that we're concentrating upon. Whereas now I think we're realizing those are key components, but it's much broader than that. So quality improvement, for example, or like cultural competency classes like in like medical schools. I mean, I think the best ones are now sort of broadening to talk about disparities, which cultural competency is one component. So I think like it's sort of woven probably with Joel's text, but we'll have to be careful that it comes across as, you know, this broad sort of front in terms of the solutions and attacks, and so we're not in some ways trapped by our language and baggage of the past, because we have a whole range of effective policies and implementations, of which cultural competency is one component.
Okay. Francis, and then we'll start with you, Edward.
Again, very stimulating conversation here, and I think another target audience that the disparities measures, this is 5A again, another bullet, another group that we could be targeting here really are the researchers, because by providing these measures, hopefully we can stimulate researchers to use them to help measure impact or outcomes along these disparity parameters for exactly the interventions we're talking about in terms of cultural competence, literacy, and so forth. I think these are all, I think we all generally agree here that these are good things, and there has been research shown to varying extents about how this might reduce disparities, but I think that hopefully by providing these measures, we can stimulate researchers to further amplify the information that we have. So I think that's another target group.
Thank you. Edward and Donna?
There's been, in the last 5 or 10 minutes here, a lot of enthusiasm expressed for things like patient navigators and increased translation services, and I'd just like to put a couple notes of caution on those very admirable recommendations. The first is that these things are really expensive, right? It's expensive to hire a cadre of translators or to deploy translation over the phone or anything like that. And when you do that, when you hire navigators and translators to get people into, say, colon cancer screening, some of the money you spend on those access things directly can take away from your ability to do colonoscopies because you can't afford a colonoscope anymore. And so any calls for these sorts of things have to be tempered by the fact that there needs to either be reimbursement for it or at least acknowledgement that these things are, we're potentially asking for unfunded mandates here. Second thing is we have to be cognizant that these things, yes, they work, but they are imperfect solutions, right? That you can have a really good translator working with you, but you still don't provide the same quality of medical care as if you speak the patient's language, right? It just doesn't, it's an imperfect solution. And the same with navigators. Navigators help, but you know, there are limits to what they can do in overcoming the widespread effects of poverty and race and ethnicity and all that sort of stuff. So I just a little bit of caution on these.
So I want to take sort of the chair's prerogative, because I think some of the things you've raised, some of us around the table feel that there are some alternative models that are cost effective as it relates, for instance, interpretive services. So I just wanted to have a few people respond to you. And Don, I'm just going to ask you just to hold off on your comment for a minute. I think, Liz, as soon as you said something, your thing would... So I'm going to interpret your body languages to mean that you have an ardent comment to share with all of us. And for everybody else who has their names up, you know, I couldn't pass on that. It's totally subjective, but I just couldn't pass.
Howard, you probably don't know this about me, but I've been working for the past 12 years on looking at the cost effectiveness of interpreter services.
Yeah, I thought so.
So I want to let you know that I bring that those years of experience to the table here, and your concerns are actually frequently expressed. Unfortunately, they're not well documented, and actually I've shown that they are quite small expenses of actually healthcare and do bring benefits. In addition, when we talk about these things, the unfunded mandates, people talk about the people. We forget that there are so many unfunded mandates in healthcare that we pay for, and no one complains about them. And really, you can't ethically provide a colonoscopy, or you can't reduce disparities. You can't do anything that we're talking about around this table unless you're able to adequately communicate with a patient in a language they can understand. So I would say that it's not really an unfunded mandate, but it's actually the only way you can actually provide the standard of care that everyone else gets in this country to someone who doesn't speak English well. And it is not, there are cost-effective ways, and Mara, I'm sure, is going to actually talk about that. There are cost-effective ways to provide them, and they reduce other costs in terms of liability, et cetera. I'm going to let Mara go on that, but I just want to let you know that if you actually do a Medline search on you, you can look at some of the information about their actual costs.
So it may be helpful for the rest of the group. I know you did some work with Hablemos Juntos and all that. Maybe you can share some of your some of the research regarding the cost of interpretive services. Counter argument, is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. So to say that it's cost effective, is that from a societal perspective?
It's from
both. What do you mean by both? But what's the other half of both?
So there's three ways you look at cost effectiveness, right? And you can jump in here, Bill, if you want. But society, the organization or an institutional standpoint, as well as the person. And I would say for all three of those people, it's cost effective. For all three of those standpoints, you look at it, it's cost effective.
Let me ask the reason, because this is a hot button.
It really is. I mean, I disagree. I think, you know, if you were to ask hospital administrators, where people have to actually pay for this sort of stuff, how they pay for it and where that money is coming out of, and the disproportionate burden it places on safety net providers, I think that there'd be a lot of pushback.
One thing I want to say is that I think that you raise a really important point, which I think everyone around this table would agree with, is that there should be reimbursement for those services, actually. That's one way in which we're going to actually promote the use of those services. And so I think that you're right, that some people do perceive it as a burden. I can tell you I've done qualitative work, and Mark can talk about this too. There are many organizations. There's Alameda Health Alliance that actually pays people to use interpreters. They recognize their value and what it does to actually reduce their costs. I mean, so it's actually not true that all healthcare organizations actually experience this as a burden, but they see it as a value. I think that we're probably going to agree to disagree on this point, but the point where I think we can agree is that there should be reimbursement. But I also think there is no way, absolutely no way, you can reduce disparities in LNP populations without providing them services in a language that they can understand. I mean, we can't have any standards here on that unless that's the first step. So
let me ask that we do this, that we just park that one for right now, and maybe we can have a sidebar regarding this issue. I think it is a hot button issue. I think a lot of people around the table may have done extensive work in this area, so I want to give other people the opportunity to comment, but I do think it's an important issue, and one that, yes, we may have to agree to disagree, but it is critical. So let me start with Donna, Mara, Norman, and Grace, and then after that we're going to take a break and a deep breath. We're going to do both. Go ahead, Donna.
Hopefully my recommendation is less controversial. Though cultural competence is within the title of the steering committee, then other related terms are cultural sensitivity and cultural humility, and my recommendation is that whenever we're referring to cultural competent type concepts within our recommendations, we instead use the term cultural sensitivity.
Okay, I think there is an alphabet soup of cultural language that is used. I think people will different terms can be used, you know, health equity, you know, there's different things that, so we have to probably decide on what would be the appropriate term.
I just feel the need to chime in that notwithstanding the need to make a decision about what you want to call it, previous NQF committees and organizationally have made decisions, so we do have
okay.
an account.
All right. All right. Duly noted.
We can expand. And
I understand. Maybe an acknowledgement that there are other terms
yes.
that are used to refer to it. Acknowledge. Okay. Mara? It's you. It's all you.
No, I know. But if we park the last issue, maybe I shouldn't be talking about it.
Well, I think it's a hot button issue. I don't want to, you know, perseverate on that particular issue because.
I guess I'll try to summarize it very succinctly and say I think we do want to be very clear when we put out a report that we're not sort of giving an out to provide to, you know, doing quality improvement because of difficulties in providing lines of services. We've recognized it's difficult. I agree wholeheartedly with everything that Liz said. I've been working for years with a national coalition in D.C. trying to get better reimbursement, but we're not there yet. And ideally, obviously, if everyone could have a bicultural, bilingual healthcare provider who needed it so we didn't need interpreters and translators, that'd be great, but we're not going to get there anytime soon. But I do want to be very cautious of how this is framed and that this isn't framed in a way that sort of identifies that this is a way to say, well, I can't do it because it's costly or I can't do it because I don't have the resources. Because Liz is right, we've done a lot of work on the cost effectiveness. We've done a report on malpractice and language barriers to show sort of the other piece of the puzzle. And so I think there is a lot of research and resources out there to help providers do this the right way. And I also think with the Affordable Care Act, there's a new non-discrimination provision that's going to go beyond what Title VI has typically done, which is applied to federal fund recipients and said you should be providing language services. And it's not tied to federal financial assistance. So anything created under Title I of the ACA, which is basically all of the exchanges, and therefore likely the plans participating in the exchanges, are going to not be able to discriminate on the basis of race, color, national origin, disability status, age, gender. So I think that's also, again, it sort of reinforces what a lot of us have been doing the work on, and it's going to continue to be that way.
Okay, thank you. Can I ask you two to put your name down so that I know that we've covered you? Okay, Norman, and then Grace.
Two quick points. I'm sorry to perseverate on the interpreter, but I think we're all missing the point. You can talk to a patient, but if you don't understand them, there's no point having the interpreter. I've had interpreters mess up a situation, mess up a consent. You have to understand the patient, what their goals are, and the interpreter sometimes just messes up the situation. The other thing is the Romana's point about team and approach to culturally competent care. If I recall correctly, the Joint Commission sent out an announcement about 2 years ago that it would be part of their accreditation standards. So I think it's not innovative and new. We should perhaps at least look into what they wrote in their language, their announcement.
Thank you. Norm, Grace,
And this will be the final comment before we begin.
Right. So I think to the point of the unfunded mandates, I think the two points that I would like to make is that, one, we need to be very cognizant that just because there's a mandate or we make the recommendation, if you don't change the fundamental workflow or how patients like Alameda County, how the patients perceive the utilization of services, you can spend millions and millions of dollars and have severe underutilization. You don't achieve that goal, and that's just a wasted resource. So I would say that, yes, you know, having interpreter services available is a really great first step, but if the attitude surrounding it doesn't change on the patient side and there aren't infrastructural programs that change that dynamic, it's still going to be wasting money. So from a health plan perspective, we spend millions of dollars setting up the infrastructure to deliver it, but the utilization remains virtually non-existent. Right. So, and then the other thing with unfunded mandate is that I think NQF and this committee is in a really great place to really make some recommendations regarding policy changes of changing the funding structure. They're seeing a huge payer move towards paying for quality rather than just incidents. Mm-hmm. The CMS, and then on the higher side, there's the patient-centered medical home and SDOs. So there's the shift that I think we can really leverage. And two is that there is precedent for compensating providers differently, and I think my industry might dislike me for saying so, because we don't want variation in claim system that really adds to administrative costs. But we do have these exception payments for centers of excellence, for physicians in pay-for-performance programs that we've been able to make work.
And when you say we, you're talking about WellPoint.
Yes, and the private insurance industry in general. So, you know, we have, you know, transplant centers of excellence, bariatric centers of excellence, physicians and people performance arrangements, so that it could be another model for hospitals and providers in underrepresented areas might, there could be some infrastructure that's set up to compensate them differently. So I'm just saying that it's not without precedent, so I don't want people to say, oh, we can never do that. But I think right now, when there's the shift in paradigm of how we compensate for physicians and medical services, this is a great time to push some of these policy events.
Okay, rich discussion. Joe, you're last. You're the
I know.
Very last
I
one.
Am
go
last
for
because
it.
I have to go.
Okay, fair enough. Duly noted. The floor is yours.
I just wanted to thank everybody for the opportunity to come here and participate in this important exercise. I think, you know, you're all doing great work. I think it's going to be really interesting to come out to see how this brief is going to come out and kind of parse these issues between, you know, quality improvement and measurement and disparities writ large. I think Denise, your point about, you know, the Medicaid differential is so important as, you know, a presumably colorblind policy issue that disproportionately affects minorities to a, you know, a huge extent. I mean, you know, you're really pushing the ball uphill when you're trying to reduce disparities and you've got this, as my kids say, ginormous difference in reimbursement. There are other kinds of social policies that are also presumably colorblind that affect mostly health disparities, health status disparities, not so much quality improvement. That, you know, the context for that would be great if you could include that in brief. But in any event, thanks again, and good luck with your report.
Let me just say one. I think I speak on behalf of all of us. I think we did an outstanding job writing the paper. So thank you so much. All right, we're going to take a 10-minute break. So we'll convene back at 10:05.
And then I'm just going to mention some of the things that they have already talked about as far as measures that they have taken.
Thank you.